I woke up this afternoon, not morning because insomnia, wanting to tell my side of the fucking story. Which is something that I've wanted to do for a very long time. I just haven't had anywhere to really tell it. I don't have other social media. I don't use social media, really. In part because, and this may be ridiculous, this may just be my paranoia, but in part because I'd prefer to hide from certain people. Nobody here, as far as I know at least. Rather, people I've known. And this is simply because any contact between the two of us is mutually assured to be detrimental to both of our health. We don't need to be anywhere near each other. I posted a Fantastic Beasts meta mammoth of a thing, and I've been thinking about that lately, and I always intended for there to be another part to it. I never did anything with it. I never made the other part, but the intent was still there. If you don't know, no worries if you don't. The thing I wrote was essentially dissecting the brain of a sociopathic narcissist, which I realize very heavy words to use, and know that I do not use them lightly. I offer this perspective because I have been in a long-term relationship with someone like that, and the thing about those kinds of relationships is when it's over, or even when it's fucking happening, you don't really get a voice. And when you do get a voice, you're gaslit and torn down at every opportunity for having the audacity to believe anything you feel, anything you say, anything you want actually matters. So, I've just kept my mouth shut for years and years and years. Partly due to fear. Not entirely. Also due to just not wanting to aggravate old wounds. But they're itching. So scratch I must. I know picking off the scab is going to make it take longer to heal, but it itches. Proverbially. Let's scratch it. I don't know if anybody's going to listen to this. I kind of don't care if anybody listens to this. I just need to fucking say it and get it out somewhere. I mean, I could talk to the couple of friends that I have, and I could talk to my family, but they've all got plenty of other things going on right now and don't need me dredging up the past. So, I don't know, maybe someone out there will hear this and have a similar experience and realize that no, they're not stupid to make the same mistakes I did. Because really, you're not. It's not stupid to want a connection. It's not stupid to want somebody to give a shit. At all. One just has to be very, very careful and selective with who that person is. And this is exactly why. I don't really know where to start with this. The beginning seems appropriate. This is probably going to be another excessively long thing. I over-explain. I know I do. Maybe overexplaining is just a post-traumatic coping mechanism. The only way out is through, or so I've been told. Don't dwell, don't stagnate, don't pause amidst the haze of your flashbacks. Let them happen, feel them, breathe through them. Then let them go as passers-by to a car crash do. No need to hold on to them, though they surely stick with you. I've been holding on to them, though. Clinging like a terrified child to their security blanket, though it's woven from fiberglass insulation and embroidered with barbed wire. Even though it hurts. It's an expected ache. A pain that I'm used to. Let it go, and what's left? How can one validate their experience in retrospect without becoming entangled again in the pain of that experience? I'll do my best to keep this as brief as I can, but this is me. It's not going to be brief. When I was 17, days from 18, I met a boy online who was just a few months younger than me. We liked a lot of the same things. Hard rock and metal. Horror movies, especially the squeaky ones with bad SFX and psychological horror, particularly the old ones. Strange musicals. Dark and offbeat humor. He wasn't much of a reader, we're polar opposites there, but I don't hold that against him. Having dyslexia isn't a personal shortcoming by any means, and it's not like anyone chooses for their brain to scramble letters up, though I will. Maintain to the grave that reading the book is 99% of the time better than the movie. My brain shuffles numbers around after all, so it's not like I've got any room to judge. He was very charming, with a hell of a sense of humor. Tall, with dark eyes and long dark hair. High and sharp cheekbones, with a killer jawline. Understated, but gorgeous, and he damn well knew it. With a wolfish grin and a potent devil-may-care demeanor, once he set his sights on something or someone, most often he'd get it. The boy could charm the habit of a nun, it seemed. Bad boys do often hold a certain appeal, an aura of thrill, the enticing possibility of an unforgettable experience. Breaking the bindings of inertia with the promise of spontaneity, for better and worse. To live is to feel, after all, and experience without emotional impact isn't satisfying. He is seductive even at a passing glance, so wholly self-assured, and if not, they're a skillful bluff. Projecting a sense of self well beyond simply confident. Every word, every gesture, is steeped in the allure of what could be. With a craving for heightened intensity and the unspoken promise of loving with a love that was more than a love, or so it seems to be. The bad boy's intoxication is wholly hedonistic, and sewn together through this mistaken paramour, together you can edge ever closer to the brink between pleasure and agonizing overstimulation. All you've got to do is decide if you're willing to go along for the ride. If the pleasure is worth the pain, after all is said and done. Wisdom requires experience and only becomes illuminated in retrospect. I was very lonely and didn't really have friends. So different to now, I know. Let alone having someone special. I was in no place to really be much of a partner, and there was a hell of a lot I needed to work on before I could be good for myself, let alone anyone else. But I was lonely, and that loneliness paired with self-imposed aloneness left me very vulnerable. Wanting someone, anyone, to really connect with was entirely my folly. I was very young and craving a connection, whether I could sustain that connection or not, whether the other person was trustworthy or not. I didn't care. Fuck caution, I wanted him. So I asked him out. And we went out. He was very charismatic in person, disarmingly so, which didn't really come across in writing, and that intrigued me further. His vocabulary, too, was much more expansive in person, or at least he knew how to use synonyms in the right context to seem so. He had a wicked sense of humor, brash and unapologetic. Definitely abrasive at times, but with the right intonation, he'd get away with making a joke of just about anything. We had a good time. It was a fun and flirty kind of first date. Very lighthearted. It was a good night. A sparkling glimmer of light in stark contrast to my usual Saturday night. We texted often through the days that followed. To say excessively would be no exaggeration. This is where things take their first turn downward. About a week later, I attempted suicide. It was my second attempt that year, and after the first, I was voluntarily institutionalized, prescribed an antidepressant, which I stayed on for a good 5 to 6 months, but its side effects were harsh, and it didn't seem to help at all. I mean, sleeping roughly 20 hours a day for months at a time is not pleasant, but at least I was too busy sleeping to feel too fucking depressed. Still, a change was necessary to have much of a life outside of my bedroom. In the weeks before he and I met, I'd been given a new antidepressant to replace the first. A well-known side effect of antidepressants is an increase in suicidal ideation, sometimes leading to suicide attempts, which I think is what happened with me. I felt okay before the overwhelming impulse to self-destruct kicked in, notably only a few hours after I'd taken my nightly dose. I don't have another explanation for the attempt. It seemed like my depression was lifting, and the intrusive thoughts that I have now, they weren't as bad then. I mean, they were there, sure, but quieter, easier to ignore. I don't have another explanation for this attempt. It seemed like my depression was lifting, but that rapid shift in a matter of hours scared me. Maybe the new influx of neurotransmitters just overwhelmed the wrong neuroreceptors. I don't know, but that seems plausible. I told on myself and was taken to the ER, and hours later, well, by morning, really, was admitted to a nearby inpatient psychiatric facility on an involuntary 72-hour hold. And this was at the same facility I'd been admitted to the previous April. The second instance was in December 2010, and remains the most recent suicide attempt at the time I'm saying this. March 23rd, 2020, FYI. I'd like it to be my last. While I was in the hospital, I was misdiagnosed and prescribed a medication for a mood disorder I don't even have, come to find out years down the line. I didn't know this diagnosis was erroneous at the time, I was just relieved to find out there was something tangibly wrong in my brain and I wasn't just fucking imagining things. This misdiagnosed disorder runs in one side of my family, while the disorder I actually have runs in both sides. Differentiating between the two isn't easy, but in retrospect, I feel like a 15-minute interview the day after a suicide attempt may not necessarily show enough range in terms of behavior to conclusively diagnose either disorder, particularly when psychosis is not present. This mess is relevant to the relationship I'm talking about, because taking meds that your brain doesn't actually need isn't going to lead to you making your best judgment or achieving relative stability. Thorough context is necessary to see the full picture. As I was in that brief interview with the resident psychiatrist, I remember hearing someone call my name from outside the tiny office door beside the rec room, saying I had a call from someone with his name. There was a phone in the hallway by the nurse's station that patients were free to use to make and receive calls at will. I guess my mom gave the number to this boy and he made a point to call. Bad timing made me answering impossible. It's not like I could leave mid-consultation, and he didn't call again. Again, bad with numbers. I couldn't call him back because I didn't have his number. I wouldn't have been able to have it memorized by then anyhow. I just barely know my own phone number now, damn. and I've had this phone for like 3 years, I'm bad with numbers. Really fucking bad. I was touched he'd try to call me, and I wanted to talk to him too. Along with the misdiagnosis, my family wasn't particularly supportive. Mom was the most supportive. I think she was just worried sick and wanted me to get help whatever it took. Nana, on the other hand, I'm sure she was concerned too, just showed it in an awkward and backhanded way. The first thing she said to me when she came to visit me in the hospital was, with her hands on her hips and a odd, grimacing sort of smile on her face, "Do you know what you put your mother through?" That hurt. A hell of a lot. I don't think she meant it with menace, but goddamn if that isn't seared into my memory as one of the most invalidating moments of my life. It felt like I didn't matter at all on my own, like I wasn't even seen for the reality of what I'd done, just as a catalyst or trigger to blame for the suffering of others. Where else do I and my anguish fit into this equation? Does it fit anywhere at all? I spoke up, I reached out for help, yet was reprimanded for causing a fuss for others. Whether she meant for this to hurt or not, it did. Suicide may seem, or in fact be, selfish. From the inside, that selfishness feels like self-preservation. At least for me. Some people do use suicide as a weapon to hurt those around them. This is undeniable. None of my attempts have been. They've been a desperate escape attempt. To spare myself the perceived inevitability of enduring further suffering. Not to hurt anyone else around me, though I'm sure they've been hurt by my attempts. These attempts were meant to hurt me for the last time. The guilt and shame I feel for causing those I love to hurt will haunt me for the rest of my life. In my darkest moments, I am wholly convinced they're all infinitely better off without me. Right or wrong. This is the truth of how I feel at my most bleak. To be told the effect my actions have on others matters more than the effect those actions have on myself didn't help to keep my depression from creeping back in. Guilt and shame do not harbor healing. Self-flagellation is a long-standing bedfellow of mine, and self-harm is a childhood friend. Self-compassion is difficult, and I realize that learning this is my sole responsibility. Support from others, though, is helpful. When I was released from the hospital and spoke to him, I was in an awful state of mind. And when he made it very clear that he had no intention of leaving, I clung to him for dear life. Though I knew I needed to be alone to work on finding a better headspace and some semblance of mental health, I chose to ignore what I knew was right and indulge in the newfound option to not be alone. I just wanted someone to care about me. He seemed to show up in my life at the perfect time. Picture this. There's a damsel in obvious distress who needs saving, and in trots an apparently valiant knight with his noble steed. She's too relieved to look past his armor and offers herself to his salvation. Though she's the only person who can save herself, and whether he realizes this or he genuinely has no malicious intent, the ending to this story is unlikely to change. Details between the beginning and the end will surely differ, but the outcome is the same. She learns to save herself. Whether this lesson is learnt with ease or the hard way, it must be learnt either way. Things moved more rapidly after that. Our conversations became more intimate and personally revealing. We bonded over shared childhood trauma. Not exactly the same trauma, just identical trauma. Big T kind. Parental neglect due to their mental illness paired with rampant substance abuse, sustaining direct abuse. The kind of perception-shaping mistreatment that sinks in, takes hold of whatever you may have become otherwise, and molds you into who you're to become now in response to those experiences. He admitted to experiencing blackout rages and warned me not to piss him off, which was another glaring red flag I should have heeded. If he could learn to handle my crazy, I figured it was only fair if I learned to handle his. Not realizing that each of us are fully responsible for our own neuroses and nobody else can manage your emotional responses but solely you. I'd taken on the role of managing my parents' emotions as a little girl. Shouldering someone else's burden was instinctive at that point, and in many ways still is. Maybe it was for him too. I took note and tried to preemptively mitigate his anger as much as possible. I fell hard and fast. Diving into a relationship too serious for either of us to navigate effectively without pausing to really consider the possibility of this being ill-advised. Codependence is a glaring pattern in my lineage, one my family seldom questions, lest we have to face our own reflection and realize we don't like what we see, and so must change this behavior if we're to find some semblance of health. It's easy to give too much. Hard to pull in your own reins when you feel you're losing control of yourself, let alone when you fear you're losing someone you love in the maladaptive way you've learned so readily. Far from impossible, though, if you're willing to do the work. Looking back, I think he and I were two aching children, looking for a gentle touch to soothe and be soothed. Maybe I overestimate whatever good may be in him, but I don't believe he's awful through and through. Still, even now. Within months, he'd moved in with me. Way, way too damn soon, I realize. But he was homeless, bouncing from one friend's couch to the next, and he'd disappear for weeks at a time, which should be another red flag, and it really was, but I didn't put two and two together. Sue me, I'm bad at math. He seemed invested, at least, when he was around. Moving in seemed like a way to actually spend more time with him. Even once he moved in, he had a tendency to disappear. Often, while in the room with me and at home, he'd spend hours on hours on hours playing video games while the world around passed him by. Not too odd for our generation, though his... Not too odd for our generation, though his hyperfocus compounded the difficulty in shifting his attention to anything else until he lost interest for the time being. When away, he'd text late at night more often than not and seldom found his own way home. I'd near always have to arrange a ride for him. This should have been another glaring indication. Someone wants to see you, they'll figure out a way. It seemed to near always be on me to find a way. Not to mention, if someone wants you, they'll make it clear. I'd come to him for sex more often than not. There was a 50-50 chance he'd turn me down, which was fine. My sex drive is higher than his. It often is in relationships, higher than my partner's. It's not a big deal if we're not in the mood at the same time. I can wait until we're on the same wavelength. It's no biggie. If he started to get frisky with me and I wasn't down, he'd give it maybe 15 minutes, half an hour, and then do his damnedest to coerce me into wanting him. After a while, I'd give in whether I wanted to or not. At least he wanted me, I thought. And the sex was near always extraordinary, intense with an all-consuming passion, kinky and fun. I could convince myself to enjoy it, even if I didn't always at first. He seemed to ramp up the sense of need and urgency he'd portray whenever my enthusiasm was lacking. Or maybe the power dynamic turned him on, I'm not sure. He made a point to learn every button to push, every little spot that sent shockwaves through me. Where to bite and how hard, exactly how to make me ache to be touched. How to leave me twitching and thoroughly satisfied, only able to hear blood pounding through my head and the ringing in my ears. By the end, it didn't seem so coercive. But if I brought up anything he did that hurt my feelings or made me feel devalued or unappreciated, he'd tell me I was, quote, too sensitive. Which, sure, I am sensitive. I can't deny this. Ignoring what your partner feels rather than even trying to come to some kind of compromise doesn't ease that sensitivity at all. It just makes the hurt person hurt more. He wanted to do whatever he wants whenever he wanted to do it, and if I made my feelings known, I was somehow trampling on that freedom. I only wanted to be shown the consideration I freely gave him, to see that what I felt somehow mattered to him in return. Doesn't seem like it ever did in hindsight. My feelings were my problem. Any effect his actions, words, or behaviors had on me were my problem. In no way did this affect him outside of annoyance or aggravation. Compromise was a foreign language to him, and the compassion he seemed to have in the beginning quickly began to dissipate into callous disregard. I don't know why I didn't break up with him early on, when the attentive facade slipped and he stopped trying to seem like he cared. Part of me didn't want to be alone again. Part of me hates giving up on people. I'd hoped he'd see how hurt I was eventually, if I could figure out exactly how to phrase what I felt so he could sympathize rather than brush me off. Maybe it would work. It doesn't help that I'm an angry crier. Well, he invariably believes that tears are a manipulation tactic rather than an overflow of pent-up emotion. I spent years as a child and teen forcing back tears. Any expression of vulnerability felt like an invitation for further pain. Expressing that anguish, instead of letting it build, is healthy. But to him, tears and manipulation are the same thing, so to mitigate my own response, I had to figure out a way to communicate that wouldn't trigger the impulse to cry. I'd try writing my feelings out and giving him the words to read, which was a bit easier for me since organizing my thoughts in my head is a bit of a clusterfuck even when I'm not emotionally charged, but it never seemed like I could explain how I felt well enough to make sense to him, or to seem valid to him. He just heard blame and criticism. No matter how I'd try to choose my words as carefully as possible, it didn't seem to make any difference. I stopped trying after a while. He'd mentioned early on that his first love had cheated on him, which is when he broke up with her, and they spent their next year of high school proverbially in separate corners. He was so hurt by this betrayal. There's no doubt in my mind about this whatsoever. That pain doesn't justify welcoming her back into his life the next year, only to seek vengeance by playing the role of perfect boyfriend, luring her into a false sense of security, and breaking up with her on their one-year anniversary. The lying, the premeditation, and his utter lack of remorse. Fuck, that's telling. Knowing he'd done this before and was entirely capable of doing this again, no matter what he claimed, I still loved him. He was hurt, yes, but this wasn't just lashing out on impulse. This was malice, plain and simple. This capability is part of what parts of him scared me. The looming threat of blackout rage, which I do not doubt is real, but I do know it was never part of my responsibility to manage, was another part of him that terrified me. His lack of consideration for my emotions, too, while expecting me to give him all the consideration in the world. Violating my boundaries while expecting utter adherence to his. These fragments of his cruelty and inability to hold himself accountable for mitigating these behaviors and traits stained my perception of him. Though I still loved and wanted only him. I thought if I was good enough, compliant, and malleable enough, maybe he wouldn't do the same to me. His abuse wasn't overt. Gaslighting and coercion are his weapons of choice, which made it more difficult for me to see through to the truth of him. After a while, his gaslighting and negligence left me feeling less hurt and more angry. Our fights became more frequent and scathing, often with me spitting venom at him through my tears. I'm not proud of a second of this. It didn't give me satisfaction, just regret and irrevocable remorse. This guilt and shame has not left me. My reactivity was solely my problem to address and resolve. Even if that meant he and I parting ways for both of our sakes. Losing all semblance of calm rationality feels disgusting. Vomiting this kind of molten vitriol hurts, and that acrid, bitter taste still lingers in the back of my throat. I was worlds away from kind to him when angry. Though he was far from emotionally available, nurturing, or attentive, me responding with venomous words wasn't justified. Being on and off a slew of medication with a growing list of behavioral side effects didn't help, particularly the drugs I never even needed. But they're not entirely to blame. Rather, an indication of how fucked up I was at the time. While they didn't help by any means, they are not responsible for my actions either. Influenced my actions, reactions, and impulses, yes, but their influence doesn't absolve me of guilt or responsibility. I began to hallucinate with one particular antipsychotic, vivid visual and auditory hallucinations of people who weren't there. I'd hear them hiss or mumble. Occasionally there were full sentences at an easily discernible volume. It seemed like my night terrors kicked into high gear with this particular drug in my system, and he'd often wake to me talking in my sleep and half thrashing around. He'd wake me up mid-nightmare and help calm me down. A softer side seemed to exist in him, though he may have just wanted to get back to sleep. When our relationship began, I had a few months clean of self-harm. And that didn't last. Self-harm was a form of self-discipline, a release for frustration and anger, a way to force myself to focus on something outside of my own damn head whenever flashbacks decided to take hold of my reality, or intrusive thoughts decided I didn't get to tune them out. Also, a form of self-punishment and an outlet for pain I felt unsafe to express otherwise. It was a coping mechanism for when the fact of feeling became overwhelming. For a long, long time, it was a security blanket for me. A safe way to realize and validate the storm raging in my head. A reliable and effective way to bring order to the chaos in me. My impulse control vacillated wildly from drug to drug. Certain mood stabilizers leveled me out, but mixing them with the wrong conjoining drug set that newfound stabilization off kilter. The disorder I was misdiagnosed with seldom is controlled with one and only one drug, so an ever-shifting regimen of meds were deemed necessary. Hell, I believe they were at the time, too. Should my psychiatrist have realized this all wasn't working? Maybe. I wasn't as communicative as I ought to have been, though, so I'm not blameless either. While on the antipsychotic I mentioned earlier, I remember looking into a mirror one day and not recognizing my face. Like there was a different face overlaying mine, a seamless mask. It seemed rational to cut that perceived mask off. Surely my real face would be underneath. So I tried to. Below my right cheekbone is a scar, roughly 2 inches, maybe 2.5, from this incident. There was only blood and bubbly yellow fatty tissue beneath the mistaken perception of that mask. I realize this is not something a sane or rational person does, and that this is terrifying to learn someone you care for has inflicted on their body. I can't justify or defend this. I can only explain what was happening in my head at the time that led to the self-inflicted scars littering my body. He wasn't home at the time. I don't remember where he was, probably with a friend or with his dad or something. When he returned, he noticed immediately, but didn't even ask why. Later on, he said in an argument we were having that he was afraid to leave lest I hurt myself again, which I understand. Though this was never his responsibility to begin with, taking on someone else's problems and burdens was instinctive to him on some level too. Maybe this admission was some level of manipulation to him, though I don't doubt my self-harm seemed to be manipulative from his perspective. The thing is, I self-harmed when he was home too. Not to hurt anyone but myself, although it did. Intent and reception aren't mutually exclusive, I realize. Reconciling the two doesn't seem like something he's willing to do, though. Maybe he's not capable of this. I don't know. I don't want to believe he's not capable of this, but actions speak invariably louder than words. Did he take advantage of my absurdly obvious vulnerability from the beginning? I don't know. I want to believe that he didn't, that he felt something genuine for me all along. On some level, I do believe the love we shared was real. As clumsy, all-consuming, and maladaptive as it was, it felt real. Maybe because we're both accustomed to love and pain being one and the same, differentiating between the two is more difficult than it ought to be. Our relationship ended with a massive fight. I was the primary aggressor. There's no excuse for my behavior. He claimed to want to take a week and see where we were then. I wanted resolution. Stay or go. He left with the phrase, enjoy being alone. To him, I am, was, and probably always will be the bitch at fault for every little thing that went wrong between the two of us. I didn't have it in me to bother trying to counter his claims. I still don't, really. What's the fucking point? He feels how he feels. This isn't going to change. He'll believe whatever he believes, will frame this narrative to suit himself, and will then behave as he sees fit. Whatever it takes to get what he wants. I can't do a damn thing about this. However, if he wants my participation, whether by vitriol or affection, this is in my control to give or refrain from giving. Participation in any capacity perpetuates his triangulation, whether for or against me, and I'd rather not engage at all, to be honest. I very simply want to be left alone. For him to go to his corner while I stay in mine, far away from each other. Nothing good can come from being in his vague proximity. Around the 4-year anniversary of this separation, he messaged me through social media. I'd blocked him long before, so he used a throwaway account. Again, I was in an awful place. He has a knack for finding me at my most vulnerable, whether this is planned on his behalf or not. His tone was odd. He seemed combative, at least in subtext, and I considered not responding at all for a few days. But again, I was lonely and deeply regretted how we ended, and I missed him. So I responded with authenticity rather than defensiveness, telling him I had no fight left in me, but if he wanted to talk things over, I was willing. He seemed eager. Once I responded, we began to mend fences, so it seemed. The past loomed over us, though, and I have no intention to make the same mistake twice with him or anyone else. I'd rather be alone than in an unhealthy relationship. Cue another round of excessive texting and what may have been mutually heartfelt communication. I know I showed the honesty and care I hoped he could reflect back at me. It seemed like true forgiveness was possible, finally. Though his version of forgiveness entailed saying I'm sorry for everything, where mine went into details as well as explaining why I reacted as I did without trying to justify my misdeeds. I explained the misdiagnosis. He confessed that he's been diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder. More specifically, antisocial personality disorder with psychopathic and narcissistic features. We both confessed to another round of similar childhood trauma, this time in the vein of certain instances of sexual abuse which neither of us were comfortable admitting to the first time around. Each of us permanently lost our more negligent parent in the interim. Both of our less negligent parents weren't doing well. We'd missed each other, still loved each other. There was a lot of reconnecting done in a brief period of time, deeper than in the past, seeming more raw and authentic than ever before. Mostly through text, as he was, by a stroke of luck, states away. Things seemed to be going well for a little while, until I made very clear that I had no tolerance for abiding him treating others with unnecessary cruelty. He didn't like that. I'd gone along with almost anything he'd wanted in the past, only agreeing to avoid a fight before it could happen. I stifled so much of myself to appease him the first time around, not standing up for much of anything I believe in, choosing my battles as best I could, which admittedly was pretty crappy for a best attempt, and this was all a massive mistake. That's not something I'm willing to do again. People-pleasing is an awful habit of mine I'm determined to break myself of. It seems like he wanted the same, whatever you say, honey, bullshit I gave the first time around. He'd praise me for growing away from past behaviors that didn't challenge him or those that absolved him of all accountability, but not those that held him in a less than sublime light. Challenging your partner is part of what enables you to grow with them, as is your partner challenging you. The same old shit will just end the same damn way. Ultimately, I couldn't shake the nagging feeling he wasn't being entirely genuine. His most recent girlfriend had cheated on him, and he'd broken up with her, so this seemed like a thinly veiled rebound to me. I talked him down from seeking revenge on her during our reconnection, repeatedly. And I'm not stupid. I don't doubt for a second he's had vengeful feelings and impulses toward me, too. While I didn't cheat and had no desire to, I damn well wounded him in other ways. He admitted to harboring an obsession in the years after our relationship ended, filling sketchbooks with drawings of me, which freaked me out, but I kept my cool. Placating him seemed safer. I can't claim he hadn't been on my mind a lot, too. Figuring out what the hell happened, why, how to heal, and how to avoid a mess like this in the future has been a major point of focus for me since we broke up. The first time, and the second time, just kind of gets more pressing and urgent as time goes by. I was right not to give my trust so easily. After deciding I was more trouble than I'm worth, he seems to have tried to get me fired. I don't know who else would have the motivation to do so, and the timeline lines up with our reparting ways eerily well. I can't say I'm surprised. Just disappointed. I do understand why he's hurt, though his actions are utterly vindictive and beyond out of line. Imagine loving and losing when your capacity to truly connect with another person is diminished at best. Imagine the pain this loss must inspire. I do believe he loved me. Maybe whatever he feels now is part of love as he understands it. Which could be why he's so hurt still and lashing out at any opportunity. In the back of my mind, part of me still loves him, and though I wholeheartedly refuse to be part of his life again, I don't know if that care will ever fully go away. Honestly, I'd be kind of worried if it did. Once I really take a liking to someone, I care. Too much, probably, most of the time. Well, not probably. I definitely do care too fucking much. Oh well. Again, I wholeheartedly refuse to be part of his life. We're not good for each other, and we never were. Part of me believes we were just too young and mutually damaged to function as a cohesive unit. Part of me believes I am incapable of truly reciprocal and unconditional love due to the volatile nature of my only experience with a romantic partner. Part of me believes he's incapable of this kind of love, and I became entangled with the wrong person at the right time. I don't know which ratio of these three is the correct combination. Recently I found an old love note I'd written him in the pages of an old book. Took me a while to muster up the gall to actually read the damn thing. Honestly, I wanted to burn it without reading this fragment of a painful memory. Putting off reading it left me climbing toward an anxiety attack, so I bit the bullet and decided to face this fear head-on before my mind could fully catastrophize this forgotten love token. In the note, I spoke of how grateful I was to him. How I didn't deserve someone like him. How invaluable his guidance in helping me to become a better person was. Reading it made me feel nostalgic, but after that nostalgia came nausea at how blinded I'd been. I learned invaluable lessons, all right, but not those I thought at the time. It seems like one of the more pressing things I learned is don't fucking have social media, don't have anything tied to you, don't be easy to find. Which kind of feels like self-punishment in a way, so while I'm not going to use fucking Facebook or Snapchat, what the fuck ever, whatever Instagram dumb shit people do for whatever fucking reason, I don't get it, but okay, it doesn't really matter. While I have no desire to do any of those, the relative anonymity Reddit gives, I feel somewhat safe putting all of this up. At least it'll exist somewhere outside of my head. Recording and posting the intrusive thoughts thing actually helped quiet them down a bit yesterday and leading into today, which was unexpected, but very nice. So maybe I do need to open my mouth and actually say what I'm feeling more. I'll work on that. I just like to sit back and analyze. Figure out if something's rational and reasonable first. I don't like just reacting. I don't like just responding. I like giving things thought. Too much thought, usually, but I'm okay with that. And to clarify, he hasn't been bothering me recently. I haven't heard a peep from him in a few months at this point, which is nice. Hopefully it stays that way. I'm just very, very sick of feeling smothered by the memory of him. So if by throwing this disaster of a relationship out for someone else to witness, I suppose, if that can help, hopefully it does. And if anyone listening to this has made similar or the same mistakes, it's okay. You made them, and they're over. You can't change the past. You can only control what you do in the future. You can't change the past. It's over, it's done, and it's gone. It lingers in your head and in your body, certainly. But that's not here anymore. They're not here anymore. And in roughly 7 years' time, you'll have a body they've never touched. You'll have a body that's never touched them either. And I think that's a beautiful thought. Sure, it takes time, but everything worthwhile takes time.